Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today, we have two great, fantastic, amazing guests. Someone new and someone not new.
That's
I don't like using the word old.
Don't use really, old.
Right? No, we don't use that word. We just say not new.
You can use that for me.
Okay, all right. Well, today we have the commissioner, the new commissioner of the Department of Labor, John Butera. Welcome, commissioner.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
Yes. And Julie Rabinowitz, the God's gift to communication
at the
State House.
Please.
How's that? Is that a good title for you?
That is not a good title for me.
Julie, you've been on this show so much, I almost think that you and I know each other about so much stuff.
Well, we do, but there's a lot of labor issues going on.
There is.
The
there's a lot of great stuff. It's a lot of great stuff. Anyways, what's your official title?
Director of Policy, Operations, and Communication.
Perfect. So, you know, we got a lot of things going on in the state, as you said. But the big news, as far as I'm concerned, is the new commissioner. So, John, what brings you to this wonderful role?
Well, as Julie said, there's a lot of things going on. The interesting thing about the Department of Labor is it touches every business and it touches every employee and most people looking for work. So it really has a profound impact on the state and the ability to move the state forward.
Before you were a Department of Labor commissioner, what did you do? Tell us a little about your background, if you could.
Sure. I was in the governor's office since day one. In fact, I helped on the campaign, so I'm commonly referred to as employee 001 sometimes. But in the governor's office, I was a policy advisor and covered a multitude of areas, including the Department of Labor. Others were the Department of Economic and Community Development, Maine State Housing Authority, the Finance Authority of Maine, and the Workers' Comp Board. So while I'm new as the commissioner, I have spent 6.5 years working very, very closely with the Department of Labor. So it's been an easy transition.
Sure. No, that's great. So you are obviously senior economic policy advisor,
yep.
Right? How do you connect economic development with workforce development?
It's very simple. You can't grow an economy without people. And as I said, the Department of Labor touches every single person in this state probably. And, you know, given some of the challenges we have regarding low unemployment, tight labor markets, it's very critical that we look at workforce development, the Department of Labor, as a conduit to get more people, to get the workforce larger, more skilled, so that we can grow our economy. I've worked for many, many years in economic development. I've called that the demand side of the equation of growing an economy. I'm kind of on the supply side now, which I think, given the current environment we're in, is where there needs to be a lot of focus.
Every commissioner comes in with an agenda of what they would like to focus on. What's going to be your focus as Department of Labor commissioner?
Really to try to expand the workforce, both internally and externally. And when I say internally, it's looking at the people within Maine, not just the unemployed. But we really got to look at all different cohorts, all different segments of populations to figure out how to get them into the workforce first, because a lot of them aren't even participating in the workforce, and then give them the skills they need. And secondly, we need to look externally, outside the state. We all know the demographic challenge that Maine has, but we need to put policies and programs in place that make Maine attractive for people to move to seek employment opportunities.
You know, I'm going to focus on that a little bit more if I can, because that's probably one of the bigger issues that I hear, certainly in my role at CMA and dealing with trying to import people to the state and attract them to the state. So the combination of challenges that are out there, not only for the economic side, you know, the energy and other things that are factors in terms of costs. If you look at the overall costs of living in Maine, especially here in Portland or the southern part of the state, they're not a lot different than Boston.
Correct.
Yet we don't pay, or we don't have the economic incomes that they pay down in New Hampshire or the Boston area. What are some of the things that you think will be a focus for you to make that happen?
Absolutely. And David, I'm glad you mentioned about, you know, the economic side, and you talked about energy. And again, I spent many, many years kind of trying to make Maine competitive from an economic perspective, lower energy costs, lower taxes, et cetera. I think we need to look at Maine as a place to be competitive for people to move to. And you're right, our wages are lower than some of our neighboring states. And as you said, particularly in southern Maine, the cost of living here is not much more different. So I think, you know, as policymakers, both from a state perspective and even a local perspective, we need to make sure that we're not making the cost of living here, the things that we can control as public policymakers, make sure we don't make the cost of living here something that's prohibitive.
Right.
And yeah, it's you know, and one of those issues, as I'm sure we're all very well aware of, is the 3% surcharge tax, whatever they're calling it, that was went through the referendum process. That does not send a good message to folks outside of Maine that Maine's a place where I want to move, gain employment, and raise my family.
You know, it's interesting you talk about the 3%, and a lot has taken place over the last couple months at the end of the legislature. And Julie, maybe you can define a little of where we're at this
sure.
point.
So, you know, looking back, we had the budget showdown in the shutdown, and the governor stood firm, and the House Republicans in particular, to make sure that 3% surcharge was repealed in its entirety. And we at the department were very supportive of that because we know that that's a major recruitment hindrance for a lot of different sectors. And it's not necessarily just your doctors and your dentists, but it's your higher earning dual income households. And when we're looking at attracting people to move to Maine, we need younger people who have families. And younger people want to earn more over their careers. And if you know that, you know, if you get a raise of a certain amount or your wife gets a raise, that you are going to be taxed more, that's a disincentive to come. So it was really critical that those kinds of choices were made at the end to both, you know, to shut down the state. And I think the department made, you know, we prepared very heavily to make sure that services would be minimally interrupted, including unemployment. But the budget, I think, makes some strategic choices to really invest in Maine, but we still have to continue to be vigilant. You know, we still have the minimum wage issue, tip credit. The tip credit repeal was another success, I think, for many Maine employers, the restaurant and the hospitality industries in particular, and the servers. The people really spoke up and made sure that something that was going to affect their livelihood, their wages, was going to get repealed. And I was there that day. We were there till 1 in the morning debating both the tip credit and the minimum wage. And I think we still have a lot of work to do around the minimum wage issue. We also were able to pass legislation to get 14 and 15-year-olds into more work opportunities. And the biggest thing we heard from employers once we announced that had passed was, well, I can't afford to hire a 14 and 15-year-old at $12 an hour. So where is the youth or the training wage? Because it's going to be difficult, maybe not this year with $9 and maybe not next year with $10. But when we get up to $11 and $12 an hour, they need to have that skill set already developed to justify the higher wage.
You know, one of the challenges with all this is just the fact that we just talked about the cost of living being virtually the same here, especially in southern Maine, as it is in New Hampshire. And there are certainly other many factors, right, that go into somebody living across the border or being here, and there's personal decisions or where you want to live. And we really won't talk about all that because that's choice. But the Department of Labor does have a lot of influence in the way that we focus on key issues for the employers. Mm-hmm. Do you plan any outreach? Do you plan any direct contact with employers, kind of like has been done over the past?
Absolutely. You know, prior to coming into the role as commissioner, you know, I spent 25 plus years essentially, again, in the economic development arena, where I was always dealing with businesses and trying to figure out how to work with them to help them grow, expand, become more competitive. I see that continuing with the Department of Labor, and in particular with my role. One of the things I mentioned to Julie the other day is I want to get out on the road, get in front of businesses, get in front of chambers, get in front of trade organizations, and really talk about how they can – we'd like to partner with them in helping to solve this challenge of you know, the workforce crunch, and also just to make them more well aware of all the different – changes that have gone on in the department. You know, for many, many years, the department was, you know, if you got a call from the Department of Labor, you didn't want to answer it because you thought you were getting in trouble. We've changed that dynamic over the past 6.5 years, and we want to continue that so that when you get a call from the Department of Labor, we want to partner with the business community to make them more successful. It's that simple, because we serve two constituencies. We serve employers and employees, and you cannot have an economy without both of them. Sure. And we get that.
From a size and scope of the department, do you see any changes that may be happening over the, you know, the period of the next few years? Especially, I know that there's less unemployment, so you see the career centers struggling a little to find things to do, for lack of a better term, and focus within that area. Do you think that there's any looking at the department? I realize it's like 95% federally funded, so I get all that. I totally understand that it's federal mandates and there's everything that goes with that. But do you find anything that you're going to focus on to try to look at that from a reallocation?
Absolutely.
Standpoint?
I think you mentioned the 95% federally funded, and you know the president's budget has just come out, and we're kind of reviewing that. And there's some changes in there, putting more resources into places that are proven to be effective and successful, and then there's some decreasing of resources in areas that are kind of been around a long time and just, you know, we've always done it like that attitude. So I think we're going to look at the resources from the federal government, which is, again, where we get the majority of our funding, and make sure we're just doing the right things. And you mentioned the career centers. We need to think about what's going to be the process or the methodology of connecting businesses and workers. What's it going to look like 5 years from now? Because it's already looking very different than it did 10 years ago. I mean, you're right. The career center traffic is down. And so we need to kind of, you know, build a better mousetrap to figure out how we do that connection. Because at the end of the day, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to give people skills, make sure we're giving them the skills that are in demand, and then connect them with the folks who are looking for those skills.
Yeah, and the skill levels have changed, right? I mean, Julie, we've talked about this, right? What is needed today is different than was needed even 3 years ago.
Right, and the client who's coming into the career center now is very different than the client who came in during the recession, who had great skills and just had been downsized and could fairly easily be reemployed with a buff up on their resume and some practice in interviewing and a kind of a broader look at their transferable skills and maybe look at a couple different industries. Folks who are coming in now have a lot more barriers because if they can't easily find work in a full employment economy, there's a reason for that. And our job is to help identify that reason and partner with the resources that can help help them overcome whatever that barrier is. And so that takes one skill set. And is the brick and mortar model appropriate for every worker down the road? We are going to need facilities to manage when there is an economic downturn and the staff to be able to handle that and that kind of capacity to be able to kind of switch on a dime. We are a department that is counter-cyclical to the economy. When the economy is bad, we do need to staff up. But when the economy is good, we really need to look at being the most efficient that we can be. We have a lot of reforms coming out in the unemployment system that will make that system much more modern and extremely efficient. And those will be rolling out in the fall of 2017 for the benefit side and for the employers in the summer of 2018, and those efficiencies are going to be critically important in technology based. And do we do a disservice when we don't make sure that everyone understands the modern way to apply for a job and that you can fill out your unemployment form on paper, but then when you need to go apply, you have to have an online application, you need a Word document or a PDF of your resume, so on and so forth. So we really need to make sure that we're serving people for the modern job search and the modern way of doing business.
Yeah, I think workforce readiness, which is what you're really talking about in terms of getting people ready to get into the workforce, has changed. And So do you see any reallocation of the individuals that do that from one aspect that they maybe need to be trained in different ways of doing things, right? Rather than, I'm talking about the person coming in the door, the actual coach or the actual individual that's helping at the center. Mm-hmm. Is there changes coming from a training perspective on that?
Absolutely. We got to make sure that they understand the new dynamic of type of employee and way to find work. And Dave, you talk about workforce readiness. You know, that even drills down to the public school system. And, you know, the governor's talked about education reform. And it's not just about money. It's about looking at how do we look at this in a different way to give not so much have somebody graduate, but to have skills and to be ready. Because, you know, I think, you know, we're probably of the same age.
39.
Yes. Well, I'm 29 now. you know, when we came out of high school back 30 years ago, you knew what work was. You knew how to work. You knew what work was about. I'm not sure that's the case today. And again, that goes into a whole different societal issue. But it's critical. We have to look at this holistically.
We're talking with John Butera, new commissioner of Maine Department of Labor, and Julia Rabinowitz. We'll be right back on the HR Power Hour, 100.5 FM. And we'll be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by cmacareer.com and maine.dalecarnegie.com. Today we're talking with the new Maine Department of Labor Commissioner, John Butera, and Julia Rabinowitz, Director of Communication.
Thanks.
Let's get into a little bit about the legislative agenda in terms of what's happening. We talked a little bit about in the first section, mm-hmm. Some of the big initiatives that happened with this last session, the 3% surcharge, the minimum wage tip credit, get all that, and the youth employment bill. I'd like to talk a little bit about the youth employment bill, if we could, for a minute. Maybe
sure.
A little clarity on that, because I've already gotten some questions and some thoughts in regards to that. The first one being, I know there's going to be a change to the poster that's coming out, and
yes.
That should be already out.
Yep,
at
the
this
poster,
point.
New poster's up, and we're updating the miner's guide, and all that's available online.
Okay, great. And where would they find it online? At the DOL?
Yep, maine.gov/labor, and then just click labor laws.
Perfect. So, having to do with abuse, is there any change or anything going to be happening with the amount of hours or the amount of timeline or the dates or times they can work? Because it is fairly restrictive.
It's quite restrictive, and we did try to expand those. This is our fourth attempt in 5 years to modernize the youth employment laws, and each time we've tried to include reforms to the hours, we have not been successful. So this time we focused largely on the occupations that the 14 and 15-year-olds can do, and to clarify and conform to federal law, where we had state law that created kind of a loophole where an employer could get stuck between the state law and the federal law if they didn't think they were covered under federal law, but really were because they participated in something like interstate commerce by accepting credit cards. So employers don't always know when they fall under that federal Fair Labor Standards Act. So we did conform that. We still also kept in the superintendent's role, which has been another area where we've tried to have some reform. And we were supportive of a bill, and a superintendent came to testify a bill. It was Joel Stekas's bill to eliminate the need for the school department. And I think that that's another area down the road that we can do, particularly in the summer when the school department office closes for a couple weeks. Employers are waiting for that permit, and they can't even get it to the department. This has been a very... it seems like it's a no-brainer kind of issue, but it's been very controversial.
Yeah, and
John.
Yeah, and you know, I go back to some of my comments about increasing the size of the workforce and giving people the skills. And we talked about when we were kids, we were all working at 12, 13, and 14. It's frustrating when every single session we put in legislation and policy to try to make that better. And the majority of people in this state agree that it's not a bad thing for kids to work. You know, the passage of this recent legislation, there was an online poll on the BDN, not our friends sometimes, and overwhelming. It was like 80% of the readers said it's not a bad thing for 14 and 15
year olds
to work.
No, it really teaches so much.
Absolutely.
Teaches so much.
So it's just very frustrating that there's a handful of people who hold on to this ideology that, you know, no, we're not going to go back to putting them in the coal mines. But kids, you know, a kid coming out of college at 22 or 23 who's never had a job, that's not
very
a good
hard.
Thing.
Very
that is
hard.
Not a good thing.
We actually had an applicant for a recent opening, and under the work experience, they had to leave it blank. And this was an individual who's been going to school, has a master's degree. And you say, how do you take a risk on someone for an important position who has never worked before?
Sure. Well, as we all know, it's not just about the skill set, but it's also the learning how to deal with people and the soft
right.
side.
Right.
Right. They'd be able to collaborate and know how to speak to elders yeah. as well as, you know, supervisors and subordinates, all levels, right, in terms of understanding that.
And you learn a lot of those skills in the workplace.
Well, you only learn it in the workplace.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to get that. A lot of times, you're not going to get right. that at home. You're not going to get that with your
right.
friends and family. That's just the reality. All right, one of the things I want to dig into pretty deep is the LD-1575 bill.
Yes.
That certainly passed, which is a lot of stuff that clarified some rules and so forth. I have a couple questions having to do with that, but let's start with, give me an overview of where we got, how we got there, and second,
sure.
you know, what it actually does, and then we'll get into some of the questioning.
So this was a department bill that we basically had been tracking certain areas that we found in the law that needed clarification, either areas where employers called us or employees called us and not understanding like vacation pay, when do I get my vacation pay if I'm leaving, in rest breaks, what's an unpaid rest break versus a paid rest break. You know, are you paid for lunch? Does the employer have to pay me? Those kinds of questions. So some of the things we did were really to clarify the law and to put into the law the way the law is actually being enforced in the department. So those were some of those areas were clarifications. We also had to deal with the Oxford comma issue, which
yeah.
some folks may have seen in relating to overtime
yeah.
of for delivery drivers who are delivering perishable goods that came out of a case involving the Oakhurst dairy drivers.
Yes.
And that's been a big meme on social media, actually, where everyone's making fun of Maine, where we had this law that we left out the comma. And so drivers were allowed to sue to get back overtime, even though the way that they had been hired and were going to be paid, which was basically by the route as opposed to by the hour, was totally legal under both federal and state law, and state law had always been interpreted that way. But the style guide for the revisor's office, which are the keepers of the statutes, they don't use a comma before the and. And so it became a huge dispute. So we went into to fix that. And so that was another piece that we addressed. But there's a lot of minutia in the labor laws, and this was something that we went for a big ball. You know, we went for the Hail Mary, and we were able to make a first down, and we thought that was pretty good.
Yeah, no, that is. So let me ask a couple of questions having to do with that from a clarity perspective, and I of course asked a few of my legal colleagues who have read the bill, and a couple of them had a couple of questions. So one of them is, if an employer must pay for short rest breaks, talking about the rest side,
yep,
what is the employer's duty if the employee needs more frequent rest breaks for an ADA accommodation?
That gets into the ADA issue. And so when we think about de minimis, we would call it a de minimis break, a bathroom break, a cigarette break, depending upon what your employment policy allows. We're going to look at how it's equitably applied across, of course, all employees in the agency. If there's a certain accommodation that needs to be made, then that's something that would have to, in terms of paid versus unpaid, if it's not de minimis, if it's very frequent, if it's something that needs to have some other kind of carve-out protection, I think that that's when we get into some other kind of medical leave or ADA issue.
Okay, so we don't necessarily have to pay for all of them in terms of what that is based upon. It's going to be dependent upon what the individual situation is. And then so we only pay for the same number of rest breaks that others get. Would that be an accurate statement?
I think that's – yes, as long as you're making sure that you're equitably treating all employees with the same kind of leave. If you're denying a bathroom break to one person but you're allowing everybody else to take a bathroom break, then that's the kind of thing that would be prohibited.
Okay. So one of the other questions that came up is in the record-keeping area, which it says here it modernizes the record-keeping requirement for teen employees. Because there are some restrictions to teens that are still on the books in terms of time limits and so forth, does any of the paperwork have to be different? Because technically it says that we're going to have the same employee records as we would for a adult versus the same employee records as a teen. But that's not necessarily true, because you're going to have certain restrictions on teens. Does that have to be spelled out in any of that?
Well, I think that when we get into rulemaking, we can provide greater detail on this, because we will have to modernize the rules to reflect the changes in the statute. But for teens, you just need to be making sure that you're showing that they didn't work beyond X hours. So if they're 14 and 15 and it's a school night, they had to leave by 7, then you need to make sure that the time card reflects that. If you're keeping accurate records of their hours worked in their time in and out, then that should suffice. What we had were one set of penalties and record-keeping requirements for teens, and then a different set of record-keeping requirements for adults. And that was we basically had repealed an entire chapter of law except for this one record-keeping requirement for teens, which kind of seemed very incongruous. So we want to make it easier for people to understand, because if you weren't looking for that regulation, it would be very difficult to have found it.
So the other clarification came in the wellness program section, and it had to do with offering incentives to employees for the cessation of, for example, tobacco products and so forth. How does that fit within federal law?
Well, this was what we really were trying to do, was to conform the state law explicitly to the federal law so that employers would not be confused and employees would not be confused. For example, if by participating in a tobacco cessation program, you were able to get a discount on your health insurance, and someone who smoked but refused to participate may have to pay a higher monthly premium by, you know, $20 a month or something like that. We brought in all the federal law to the LCRED committee, and we brought We worked with the Bureau of Insurance and their counsel to make sure that we brought language that would show that federal law trumps state law in this area, and that we were doing what would conform and be explicit for employers. The Democrats on the committee were not in favor of passing anything that would look like we were changing the law to allow an employer to discriminate against a smoker, even though that difference in a payment is federal law. And it's federal law not only under the Affordable Care Act, but also under the Equal Employment Opportunity Act. So there's multiple federal statutes that support that federal law preempts state law in this area. So employers are still, as long as you're complying with federal law, you'll be fine. We were able to clarify the wellness program, but we were not able to get the conforming language to federal law in there. So we would interpret it, if someone made a complaint to us, if you're still conforming with the federal law, then you're still fine.
Okay, so that's the basic rule of
thumb. Right, but we
go with federal law, right, because it's pretty much now going to mirror state law in terms.
Well,
of
we couldn't get state law to mirror federal law, but we interpreted that federal law preempts
okay.
that.
Okay, John, one of the questions that I might have for you in regards to where we're going would be, there's a question that keeps coming up about drug testing and the ability, because we're heading towards changes in medical marijuana to full open recreational use. Employers have a lot of questions about this and are thinking to themselves, you know, how does this really focus? What's the thought process from the new commissioner? What's the thought process from the DOL? Where do you see that going?
Well, again, it is a complicated issue because it cuts across a lot of different, not just social issues, but I think even agencies. You know, at the end of the day, we want safe workplaces. That's ultimately the goal, is to have safe workplaces. So, you know, we need to dig into, you know, the laws of, you know, the new marijuana laws. We need to really kind of see how they are either consistent or not consistent with federal law. And one of the frustrations that we've had as an administration is Maine seems to go above and beyond, you know, federal compliance on a lot of things, not just labor laws, but environmental laws, you name it. We always seem to go above and beyond. And the governor's, you know, been very adamant, and we've done a very good job of trying to pull those all back to some federal requirements. So, you know, we're going to really make sure that we look at the current Maine law, federal law, but also be very, very cognizant that we need to make our workplaces safe and keep our employees safe, because they're their greatest resource we have. So that's paramount.
The department spent a lot of time looking at this issue, and we've talked to our counterparts in Colorado. Colorado has no drug testing law. So it is a determination that's made by the employer and the employer's legal counsel in looking at the federal law as to what they consider to be appropriate for their workplace. And their case law, as well as the statutes in Colorado, allow the employer to set the tolerance level for any or subsets of their employees. So you can have zero tolerance for 100% of your staff, that you can't test positive, you can't use it, you can't use recreational marijuana, or even medical marijuana. And then you could go to that, you don't, doesn't matter, anyone can use it. It, you know, you just can't be impaired at work. Or somewhere in between, that some people can have a level that they test for as long as they're not impaired, and others on their team do have a zero tolerance level. Maine statutes are so not that. You have to allow someone to use medical marijuana. You don't have to allow them if they're impaired, but you cannot deny them employment if they have the certification. Our drug testing statutes are giant loopholes you can drive trucks through. You can accident.
That's
and
the real struggle,
it's,
right?
It's such a problem.
Drug testing, because even for cause, it's very hard to get a drug test here in the state. And I recognize that this has been an issue that's been going on for years. I'm not trying to solve it today. I'm just simply saying, is it the intent of the department to continue to push to try to fix that problem?
Very much so. And we've tried for the past 3 years to reform that drug testing statute. And I think the legislature dropped the ball last year, right when there was a controversy about the signatures around the marijuana legalization referendum, and it didn't look like it was going to go on the ballot. And that's when they were voting on the bill. And I think that they lost their sense of urgency. But now we have a sense of urgency. So we will be involved in that discussion and advocating to have much clearer and more effective policies. And I think looking at some of the things that Colorado has done, they have had employers leave in Colorado because they couldn't, you know, they felt that their workforce was not as effective or efficient because of legalized marijuana. And God forbid that happened in Maine. That's well, the last thing we need.
We already have that problem, right, in terms of other reasons. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by cmacareer.com and maine.dalecarnegie.com. Today we're talking with the new Maine Department of Labor Commissioner, John Butera, and of course our favorite Director of Communication from the Maine Department of Labor, Julie Rabinowitz. So just completing our thought process on the drug testing issue that we talked about in the last segment, I certainly recognize impairment is the preemptive issue, right? Somebody working and they're impaired, and as you said, John, safety comes first.
Absolutely.
I think everybody agrees with that in terms of it. But there are employees that are very frustrated with the fact that when they have situations that they can't do a random test, they can't do something to make sure that their employees can be safe. And that's probably the frustration that I hear the most out there in terms of where the current issue is. So just trying to see where we're going with it, if this, you know, continually push on it and so forth.
Obviously, the legalization of marijuana is a big driver. And there is the committee, the Marijuana Legalization Implementation Committee, the MLI Committee.
Because we love acronyms.
That's right. they are recommending legislation this fall, based on hearings that were held over the summer, and input from employers is going to be critical in following that legislation and making sure that your voices are heard when these things come up, because we really need very clear statutes governing this. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about drug testing for marijuana. When we talk about the opioid crisis, we really want employers to have the tools to be able to, in our workforce shortage, you know, when we look at making sure that people recovering from addiction have stable employment and the community and the stability and the financial security that that brings, that's so critical to the recovery process, that those individuals do work in an environment where the employer has a little carrot and a stick. And drug testing can be a stick, not punitive, but an incentive to help people stay clean.
And in
all the data that we've gotten from our analysis of the drug testing reporting that's required back to the Maine Department of Labor of employers who test, random tests are the best incentive. We see really no increase in positives from the folks who are using random testing. But yet we restrict random testing in the statutes to employers with more than 50 employees unless it's a safety-sensitive position.
And yet, when you think about the state of Maine, that is a small segment of people who only can test. You know, under 50 employees is a majority of the state.
Right. Yeah, like 95%.
John, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, Julie really hit the nail on the head here because it's about impairment. I mean, we really need to make sure that we're giving our employers the tools to allow themselves, afford themselves the ability to have a safe environment and to work with their employees. I mean, it's a partnership when you really think about it. When you know, an employer and employee becomes a partnership, and you want to be able to create a positive partnership where they both benefit, where the employer gets a good employee that's safe, that's productive, and the employee has a job that they is self-rewarding, is fulfilling, and provides them, you know, the financial wherewithal to be a good productive citizen.
You know, here it is, first part of September, as we think about participation by HR professionals as well as business owners in Maine in getting involved and making their voices heard. What's the best way for them to approach that? What's a call to action for them over the next month or two before this information comes?
Well, I think people need to stay engaged with their trade associations or let their professional, you know, representatives in the House and in you know, the lobbyists on up in Augusta need to know that this is an issue that these employers are concerned about. And they also need to let their local legislator know. And often businesses are afraid to come out because they don't want to be seen as political. But when it's an issue this critical for the future of our workforce, for the future of our economy, if employers feel like they're in an environment that isn't supportive of what they need to grow, and drug testing is a piece of that, that's another incentive for them to leave.
Yeah, I can't stress enough for business owners, HR professionals, people who are dealing with this issue on a daily basis that really affects their ability to run their businesses and grow their businesses, contact your legislator. I mean, and it doesn't take much. It's a phone call, it's an email, whatever, because if they don't hear from folks, you know, there's a lot of squeaky wheels that hang out in the halls of Augusta on the second and third floors, and generally they're not the people who are working every day to, you know, meet payroll and create jobs. So it's very important to call your legislature, because when they start hearing a few phone calls and they start hearing getting a few emails, it becomes an issue. And, you know, the case in point with the tip credit, that's a perfect example where that was just going to be, you know, pushed down the throats of the main people. And the servers themselves stood up and said, no, listen, we're the ones being affected here.
Yeah, no, it's a great example of people rising and having their voices heard. And I know from talking to senators and representatives that two or three individuals coming forward is far more impactful.
Makes a huge
difference.
Than any
lobbyist or anybody in the public eye. It's huge.
And I've talked to a restaurant owner who owns at least one restaurant in Portland, and he had two opioid overdoses in his kitchen. That's the kind of example of how this is affecting Maine businesses and employers. And the, you know, how do you deal with that as an employer in the middle of, you know, running your business in an everyday operation? Those are the kinds of things that we need to help employers have the tools to make sure that all their employees are safe. And luckily the two individuals were able to, you know, survived. But those are the kinds of stories that the legislators need to hear.
All right, switching gears a little bit. Unemployment reforms, you talked a little bit about them. How about giving an overview of what exactly that's going to look like? I think it's LD 1530. So talk to us a little bit about what that's going to impact and how that looks and where you see that going.
We have a couple of reforms that were passed as part of the budget and a couple of reforms that were passed as part of 1530. One is going to be if you are an employer and are audited by the department and you want to appeal that decision, you used to have to go to the Unemployment Insurance Commission, and we found out that that technically was a violation of federal law. So we changed it. So you now can appeal to the Division of Administrative Hearings, which is actually a benefit to you because that allows you two potential appeals, one to the division and then to the commission before having to go to court. So that can be a positive because going to court is more costly, as we all know. We are changing the incentive, and I think this is really a workforce issue, to keep people tied to the labor force when they're collecting unemployment. Right now, you can only keep the first $25 of your unemployment benefit, which if you're getting about $250 a week in unemployment benefits and you go to work for $10 an hour, you would end up getting an unemployment benefit for like $50. And that's not paying for your gas and childcare. So $100, we think, is an initial initiative. We want to keep looking at that to make sure that even if you're working part-time, that's a help to our employers, keeps you tied to the labor force, it helps you in your work search, and is potentially a pathway to a new job. We're also have a couple changes. One is if you voluntarily reduce your hours, you go to your employer, and under the previous law, you could actually file for unemployment even though you asked to reduce your hours. You didn't lose your job through no fault of your own. So that is an important reform that I think will affect a lot of individuals and employers. And also, we're looking at changing the benefit chargeability to make it inversely proportional, mm-hmm. and starting with the separating employer. And then this winter, we're going to be looking at tax.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of a general theme is unemployment benefits are for those who, by no fault of their own, need them. And we want to make sure that we're true to that and that people aren't abusing the system because, you know, that's money coming out of employers' pockets. And we want to be very judicious in making sure that you deserve and you legally have the right to the unemployment benefit.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we'll be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. We're having a great discussion with the new Commissioner of the Maine Department of Labor, John Butera, and Julie Rabinowitz, the Director of Communications for the Maine Department of Labor. Two initiatives that I worked on. One, Maine Hire a Vet, is underway.
So once again, we are back with Maine Hire a Vet. This is our third year. Our goal is to have at least 100 employers hire at least 100 veterans in 100 days. And we kick it off on Labor Day and end it in December. We are focusing especially on recruiting veterans from out of state or who are now separating from the military or will be shortly to bring them to Maine. And that's our goal. So if you're an employer and you want a great hire, please sign up for Maine Hire a Vet so we can help promote great veterans to your business.
No, it's great. We see a lot of them coming in and really trying to, what we'd say, civilianize, right? Switch over to civilian jobs. It's great. The other initiative of sexual harassment training for minor reform.
Yeah, we did a minor reform there. We were employers who were asking about, when am I supposed to be training for sexual harassment? Call the Department of Labor because the training requirement's under us, but the sexual harassment law is really under Maine Human Rights Commission in Title V. We would say, oh, you got to call Maine Human Rights Commission. And then Maine Human Rights Commission would say, oh, you've got to call the Department of Labor. So we were now going to be enforcing the training requirement. There would be a fine if you don't do the training, but also to clarify, you just need to have some we're basically going to provide you a checklist as an employer so you know what you need to train on, and then you just have the employees sign the checklist, and then you have proof of the training. Because what was happening with people getting trained, there's no requirement that the employer retain any proof of that. And then when you go over to Maine Human Rights Commission down the road, if you have proof of the training, that may be an affirmative, you know, maybe something in your favor if a case is.
Yeah, no, sexual harassment training, as we do quite a bit of it here in the state, really focuses on making sure that people understand what's going on, right, and that it's covered. John, I'm going to have you wrap up here for the last couple minutes. You know, maybe a recap of where you see the department going and where your focus is.
Well, again, you've heard from Julie a lot of the what I call the weeds of what's going on within the department, and those are critical. But when you kind of pull out of the weeds and look at it from 30,000 feet, as I said, the Department of Labor touches every business, every employer, and it's very important that the department continues to understand internally that we serve two customers. We serve the employees and the employers. Additionally, I think it's also very important that the world of work has changed dramatically, and employers, employees, and the department needs to recognize that and kind of be forward-thinking to say, how is the world of work going to look like 5 years from now, so that we can be the conduit to, again, connecting employers and employees. And the other thing I'm going to be focused on, you mentioned early on, David, about our funding being 97% from the feds. The feds have been very rigid in the funding and the silos. And, you know, we have a new administration of which the LePage administration is fairly friendly with. So I'm going to spend some time trying to figure out how we get more flexibility into the system, because that can only be helpful, especially when the world of work is changing so fast. You know, why rely on laws and rules that are 20, 30 years old when we don't operate that way anymore? So there's a lot going on. It's an exciting time. I'm thrilled to be there. There's a lot of great people in the department. And, you know, we're always a phone call away.
You know, I want to thank you very much for being on the show today. Welcome as the new commissioner, sir. And Julie, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by VeralDana.com.
Hi, this is Tawny Alvarez from VeralDana. Has your company ever found itself the respondent in a charge of discrimination filed with the EEOC or the Fair Employment Practices Agency in your state? If so, did you handle the response in-house or use counsel or a human resources agency to respond? If you handled it in-house, how familiar were you with the procedures involved in the matter, as well as the future effects any such findings may have on your organization? Understanding your risk in these situations is paramount. The first thing one should do when receiving a charge is to contact your insurance carrier to find out if you have coverage for the matter. Your agent will likely act as a helpful resource in navigating this difficult situation. Also, recognize that if you are unaware of the events leading up to the charge, any investigation you conduct in response will not be protected by attorney-client privilege, and accordingly may be discoverable at some later point in the proceedings. Should you find yourself the respondent in a charge with the EEOC or a state agency, contact a member of VeralDana's Labor and Employment Practice Group to discuss your options and the risks associated with each course of action.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VeralDana.com. Next week on the HR Power Hour, Barry Lawrence, Director of Communications for HRCI, that's Human Resource Certification Institute, will be our guest. He's going to be talking about an HRCI study that reveals the need and desire for more strategic talent management initiatives. We're going to be talking about the current outlook for the HR job market, and we're going to be talking about new stuff at HRCI. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.